you can still succeed and do a lot of things horribly, but you won't maximize your success.
Hello and welcome to the Fresh Press Podcast, a podcast that talks about everything juicy, industry discussions, stories, and advice. This is the show for anyone looking to learn more about the cidery or cold press business.
If you have a really, really great brand, website, design, product photography, and your product's just kind of okay, well, guess what? You will still do better than a person who has a great product, with terrible design, terrible branding, terrible perceptual value.
I'm your host for today, Alexander Wolf, and today we're going to be talking about the cold press business, specifically about the phases of growth you might experience and how to plan to make sure you have the right equipment for that growth.
You know, if I do the math and think, okay, we need to do 100 orders a day in order for this to make economic sense, but we can't even do one person's order in 30 minutes, then the production doesn't make sense at all.
We will be chatting about this with the help of Andrew McFarlane, founder of Start a Juice Bar. The team at Start a Juice Bar are world-leading experts helping you launch a profitable juice business.
To me, it doesn't make sense that if not 100%, at least 90%, of the businesses that we consume food from should be contributing to our well-being. And so that is really the grander mission of the company, is to empower well-meaning and well-intentioned health folks, entrepreneurs, in order to run these healthy food service concepts so that their neighborhoods can benefit their communities, their states, their countries, and so forth.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So we did a little bit of an intro for you, but why don't we help the audience get to know a little bit more? Can you tell us more about maybe your journey into cold press juice business and how did you get started?
Sure. Depending on how far back we want to go, but for me, I think like a lot of juice entrepreneurs that we work with, a lot of this always starts with sort of like a health revelation. And for me, my journey was one of almost, I remember I was working on this project and one of the gentlemen I was working with, I was having dinner with him and he basically enlightened me to a whole lot of things I had not thought about with regards to my health. And that took me down this rabbit hole of starting to juice fast. And I remember the first time I did a one-day juice cleanse, I was just like, how do people go without eating? I had headaches. I was just like moody. It was like horrible. But anyway, that was kind of the beginning of me starting to do that more and more and just seeing a lot of shifts in my health and wanting to share that with other people. So I was kind of the quintessential person that was showing up to parties where everyone was drinking, but then I had, you know, two 32 ounce jars of juice and people were like, what's in there? It looks like blood. I'm like, oh, it's beet juice and it's got celery. And I found that it was almost like a light bulb went off and I was like, there's this thing that is so obvious to me now that is hiding underneath everyone's noses, but nobody's really aware of it. Nobody's like taking advantage of this new way of, which is new for me, but this way of really nurturing our health by consuming fresh fruits and vegetables, and just seeing what that can do when you really are consistent with it and you just have such a high dose of nutrient intake that I think for me to that point I had never experienced. And so that was the personal dimension of me getting really into this. And then the evolution into me doing it as a business, I was in the entertainment industry previously, and I found that I didn't feel like I was helping people. I didn't feel like I was really helping the world in a meaningful way. I felt like, okay, I'm entertaining people, but it's a little bit mindless. It's not something that I feel like is my soul is connected to at this point. So I was coming of age and I was in my mid-20s, and I really felt the need to do something that I felt like was contributing to the world in a real way. And so I found that at that time I was really getting into health, and I thought, you know what, I want to start a juice business. And I was in LA, and there was probably a handful of juice bars that were really doing things in a quality manner. There was a company called, I think it was Beverly Hills Juice at the time. They'd been around for, I don't know how long, 20 years or something. And I think the guy who started that company invented his whole, I don't even think there was any like cold press companies the way they are now. I think he made like a hydraulic press out of like steel plates or a jack or something, and somehow was able to get this approved by the health department. But, you know, that was one company. And then there was just, you know, in a market like LA, which was so big, there weren't many that stood out in terms of having a quality product. And so I felt like, you know, there's an opportunity. Let me go ahead and go down this rabbit hole. And that's what I did. You know, I put all of my effort and attention into starting this business. And it was really eye-opening. It was very humbling. It was very beautiful and inspiring in many things. But over time, yeah, I figured out what makes these businesses work and was able to start helping other people. But that's the, you know, that's one version of that story.
In the beginning, what do you think were your biggest challenges when you were just getting established in your business and then a little bit of growing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's interesting because I was always very entrepreneurial, and I kind of make this distinction between being entrepreneurial and being an entrepreneur. It's sort of like someone who does something, like I have an orientation and disposition towards entrepreneurship, and I'm doing these little projects here and there. Like I started my first business when I was 16. I had a t-shirt company, and then I remember at one point I bought this like little gaming machine that I put in my friend's mom's coffee shop. And I always had these little things, but I never had a business to the dimension where I would say I had consistent cash flow, I had financial responsibilities as staff, everything. So I think one of my biggest challenges in the very beginning was coming from a background of being in the entertainment world and not having ever worked in a restaurant. I was simply an observer. And I think when you're an observer, you take for granted the complexity of what it actually means to run a food service business, because you're like, everyone makes food for themselves. You know, like I make juice at home. You know, you don't think about the fact that these two things don't really correlate in the way that you think that they do. And so I remember the very first day that I had a business partner at the time, and he and I were operating. We started with a juice truck. And, you know, every new food service entrepreneur has the ideas of serving everything to everyone, right? You don't want to turn anyone away. So you're like, yeah, we're going to make this. We're going to make juices, and we're going to have ice cream, and we're going to like, you go crazy. And so I remember a couple of young guys about our age came and ordered like a smoothie, a juice. And like, I don't know, I think at that time we were serving these like quinoa bowls or something. And it took us probably 30 minutes to make this one person's order. And at that point we were scrambling and running around. And I was like, we don't know how this actually works in practical terms. So that was the first light bulb moment of, this is a lot more complicated than I thought to actually, you know, if I do the math and think, okay, we need to do 100 orders a day in order for this to make economic sense, but we can't even do one person's order in 30 minutes, then the production doesn't make sense at all. So it was pretty much day one on the ground, first or second order, me realizing I don't know what I'm doing from a production standpoint. And I hadn't, there's more to it than meets the eye from, you know, customers' point of view. So that was the first time. And I think through trial and error, and I'm grateful because I learned a lot of probably difficult lessons quickly, probably out of necessity of just, hey, if I keep going the way that I'm going, I'm going to run out of money. And it's not cost effective or efficient. So I have to make some dramatic changes quickly. And I think unfortunately, I think a lot of new entrepreneurs don't do that. I think that they might have a sense or a feeling that something's not going right, but they don't do the hard thing, which is stop doing everything they're doing and try something completely different. And so for me, I remember on many occasions, I kind of cut my menu totally in half, right? And changed the way we were doing things, changed sizes of things, changed locations, things that I just knew, like, if we don't make these decisions, we're going to run out of money. I'm not going to be operating anymore. So that trial and error through kind of the pain and discomfort of either working really, really hard or running out of money or getting close to it made me more difficult decisions and iterate in the right way, in the right direction to eventually, you know, refine the model and make it better and better and better and better. And to me, I think that's what all business is about. It's about hopefully not making those mistakes. I think that's the big reason that our company as it exists now, because it's very expensive and it's, you know, emotionally difficult and it's energetically draining. But the goal is to get better and better, because no business is perfect. And I always remind people that it's like, even if it's a company that's a franchise and they've been around for 10, 20 years, there's no perfect company. And what makes a company work is learning from the mistakes that you've made previously and continuing to grow. And hopefully the foundation that you're starting from is solid enough that it's a foundation for you to build upon. But that was, you know, kind of what happened for me. It was years and years of learning. I think it really took probably a good 3-4 years before I felt like, okay, I really have a pretty solid handle on the complete, you know, operational process and model and the principled thinking around the business. I think entrepreneurship is a language. Like any language, there's a point where you can understand segments. You know, like I started learning Indonesian about a year and a half ago. And there's a point where you become fluent, where you can actually form sentences and you can actually have original thoughts in the language and you can tell jokes. And like, there's a comfort that you find, but that comes from usually making a lot of mistakes, saying things wrong. And, you know, but you have to have a pretty good grasp in order to start to get creative with what it is that you're doing. And I feel like business is no different. I think a lot of times people have these disconnected tropes of how to run a company, but they're much more cerebral or conceptual until you're really an entrepreneur and you're on the ground and you're doing it day to day, and it makes more sense. But so many clients will tell certain things and I'm like, that's a bad idea, don't do that. They're like, no, trust me, it's gonna work. And they do it and then they're like, oh, this isn't working, but now I know what you mean and why you said it that way. I had people who I spoke to years before, and then I ran into them at a conference, these young guys, and they were like, when we first sat down and talked to you before we started our company, we were like, we didn't understand what you were really saying. They didn't grasp it. And then it took them going through the difficult work to get the principles of what I was talking about, because they had to feel the pain of it a little bit. So, you know, I think they say a foolish man learns from his own mistakes and a wise person learns from other people's mistakes. Granted, you know, we try to do that as much as we can, but sometimes we have to learn certain things on our own. So, yeah, I'd say it took me about a good 4 years before I felt I had a pretty good grasp. And there's always ways to tweak and tweak and tweak, but that was, for me, it took me that much time to get a pretty strong foundational knowledge of how these businesses operated. And I probably lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in that process.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us have to feel that pain and then learn to learn from some other people's mistakes. But we have that pain in the back of our mind. We're not going to do that again. But yeah. What was the mission when you began to start a juice bar?
Yeah, so for me, it was when I started, the closest I got to having mentorship and mentors was, which most states have, is you have like a small business association. You walk in there and you have somebody who's probably like a retired entrepreneur who's just volunteering their time. They enjoy mentoring people, but they don't have industry specific knowledge. So they have kind of general things to understand, like, yeah, you got to put your business plan together and you should do a bunch. And like, you know, it's high level information and stuff that you should know and it's helpful, but it's not specific enough to really help me avoid the pain that I went through. And I saw that a lot of people, when I was running my company, started approaching me once I had figured things out and just saying, hey, I'll pay you to like watch what you're doing in the kitchen, or can you teach me to do what you've done? And I realized that, wow, there is a really big gap, because I didn't have that support. It just didn't exist. And I had to pay for it the hard way. And had I known that there was a way to do it more simply, I probably would have done that if I was smart enough at the time. But I was probably too immature to pay someone else to help me. But, you know, there's two routes people go through. People go through either a franchise route, which I was thinking about originally too. I remember looking at like Jamba Juice franchises and a bunch of other like kind of local statewide franchises. And I thought they just didn't have the kind of menu that I could really be proud of. And so I wanted to do my own thing and really create products that I felt like I wanted as a consumer, which I did. But I didn't have the structure to rely on. So I kind of had to reinvent the wheel, which is also not a wise approach. And so for me, with our company, the mission is to, one, give people the benefits of a franchise without any of the kind of restrictive or costly downsides. And also to, on a larger level, to create a world where there are more healthy food service concepts than unhealthy fast food businesses. Because I feel very strongly that part of the you could say sanity and sobriety of a society is going to be directly connected to how much they take care of their health. And to me, it doesn't make sense that if not 100%, at least 90% of the businesses that we consume food from should be contributing to our well-being. That is a reflection of sanity for a person to understand that your health is at the foundation and backbone of everything that you do in life. If you don't have your health, that relationship you're pursuing, that career you're pursuing, that job, whatever it is, you cannot pursue because you're not well enough to actually pursue it. So it should be the fundamental desire and focus for people in order to have these, you could say, secondary desires. And so that is really the grand mission of the company, is to empower well-meaning and well-intentioned health folks, entrepreneurs, with the skills and tools that they need in order to run these healthy food service concepts so that their neighborhoods can benefit their communities, their states, their countries, and so forth. I see a lot of well-meaning people, a lot of people who get into the restaurant world, which I'm sure you've experienced too, often say they're all passion and no process. They're all passion. It's like, I want to start this business because my heart is telling me to do that. I'm like, that's great. But there's no thinking process around it because they think that their passion alone, because they probably heard a lot of romantic stories about entrepreneurship of some guy who started making muffins in his garage and everyone loved these muffins so much that there was a line around the block, and then they got this big investment from Bill Gates, and now they've got this, you know, See's candy brand or whatever the big right. brand is. They believe this in their mind, but that's really a fairy tale, because I often say that if you have, let's say, the passion to do brain surgery on a loved one, but you have no knowledge of how to do it, your passion isn't going to save that person's life. You need the knowledge in order to, and it's knowledge is more important than passion, because the person who doesn't care about what they're doing but knows how to do it will be more successful than the person who cares what they're doing but doesn't know how to do it. And so part of also in all of that, this is understanding that we need to have a strategic approach to heart-centered, mission-driven businesses, because without that, we're not going to get very far.
No, I think what connected with what you were saying and kind of hit me was having the structure, having that franchise model without being tied to all those franchises. So you're basically buying the blueprints and buying, you know, the procedures that took you years of pain and money. But I mean, it gives you a big step forward. So I really like that. Well, we're here to talk about equipment. So why don't we get into equipment? When people are just getting their juice bar going or cold press juice brand going, what's the most common framework that you see them thinking through when they think about buying equipment?
Oftentimes, I think the framework, one of the biggest kind of limitations in thinking in the framework is, I'm going to do whatever's cheapest. You know, people often ask me this question of like, how can I start a juice bar with the least amount of money? And I get where that question comes from. But it's not the right question, because I kind of frame it another way. It's like, if you were to want to, let's say you're an Olympian and you want to perform at the highest level, right? You wouldn't think like, how can I buy the cheapest shoes, right? You wouldn't think that way. You wouldn't think about like, what is the cheapest thing for you to do, because that is a defensive strategy. And in business, you need defense and you need offense, but you need to understand when you're employing and implementing one or the other. And so what you would say to yourself, if you wanted to perform at the highest level, let's say as a Olympian, someone who's playing sports, is, what do I need to do to accomplish my goal of becoming an Olympic gold medalist? Because both of those questions get you different answers, right? If you ask the question of, how can you start a juice business for the least amount of money? It probably won't be an optimal scenario for your success. It will just get you open for the least amount of money. But the reason you're starting business is to succeed and to thrive. That's really why you're doing it. So the question you need to ask is, and this is just a frame for how you're thinking, is, how can I be obviously efficient and effective with my finances? I don't want to waste resources mindlessly, but I want to be as successful as possible to let me work my way backwards from what the steps and the routes are to get me there. So how that relates to your question more specifically is, if someone's asking that question, the cheapest equipment is not going to be generally always the best equipment. So there are, you know, hydraulic presses out there that people can get that are like countertop presses, and they're like, oh, that seems accessible financially. This is a $5,000 machine, or this is a $15,000 machine. But what they don't understand about that is, if you're selling any reasonable amount of juice, like you intend to, if you're a juice bar, you're going to end up blowing all that money out with your labor, because it's going to be way too slow, right? So you end up wasting all the money you think you saved in the long run. But then on top of that, the other downside is you still don't have that piece of equipment. So at the end of the year, when you've spent an extra $50,000 on your labor that you didn't need to spend because things were just going slow for you because you didn't have the right equipment and you did what was cheap as opposed to what was effective, you still don't have that piece of equipment that's going to make your time efficient. It's a sunk cost. All that labor is a sunk cost. That piece of machinery you bought is a sunk cost. Now you still have to buy that new piece of machinery to make you more efficient, and you're stuck. A story I'll share with you as it relates to that, there was a fellow juice bar entrepreneur in my community that I befriended. We were friends, and we kind of talked about things like, how are things going? What are you doing here and there? You know, he was maybe like a couple miles away from me. Nice guy. And he was busy, but it was really interesting because I probably opened my business maybe a year before him. He was doing well, but I noticed our experience as business owners were totally different. He was in there working all the time. Anytime I walked in there, he was working. He was working every single time. And I was just like, chill. I'm like, my business is making money. I show up once, you know, a month for 5 minutes, check on things. But usually I'm at home looking at the sales, seeing how things are going. And I was like, what's going on, man? Why are you still in here? He's like, yeah, the labor's through the roof. Like, I just can't afford to get out of here. And I said, well, what are you doing? I was like, what kind of machines are you using? He's like, oh, I've got 4 Norwalks. I was like, what? I was like, brother, you can't do that. That this does not work. You're spending way too much time doing all this stuff. So of course, yeah, with minimum wage, how many employees you have to have. When people don't get that, when you're in food service, you are really in the manufacturing business. That's what you're doing fundamentally. You are doing food manufacturing. You're doing food manufacturing, it's all about efficiency of process. Yes, there is a service component of that. There's a front end component. So it's not just purely manufacturing, because you have a more in-depth customer service experience. But fundamentally, when you're in the manufacturing business, it's all about having efficient robots. That's the most important part of your success. Efficiency of process. And generally people are like creating custom robots, whatever. And people realize, yeah, a juicer is just a robot. It's a robot. And the more efficient that robot is, guess what? The more money and time and everything else it saves you to reinvest in the business to continue to grow and compete with, you know, on a larger scale. And so I'd say that's probably the biggest mistake when it comes to people thinking about equipment. It's just they're not thinking long term. They're thinking short term and money saving, which I get, because for many people, when it's your first business, there's a lot of these kind of like elusive, intangible aspects. People don't sit down and do the math and go, oh, if I can make an extra, you know, X amount of juice per day with fewer employees, what does that mean every day times 7 times 4 times, you know, 12? What does that mean at the end of the year? No, most people aren't doing that. And the people who do think like that are generally the ones who are the most successful, because they have the right brain to make informed and educated decisions. It's not as emotional. Whereas like the idea of like, spending $15,000 feels a lot better than spending $30,000, you know? And like, you know, and it's a painful thing, as opposed to, you know, I think people with their health, it's the same predicament, right? It's like if a Coca-Cola killed you the second you drank it, nobody would drink it, right? It's the fact that it does it slowly over time is the same thing with, you know, your sales bleeding out. It's the things that you don't see that bleed you out over time that are the things that really hurt you, because they're invisible to you. And I think that's one of the biggest issues with the way people approach these things philosophically, as well as how it connects to the equipment.
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses are, without realizing, because they don't check their finances, they don't, you know, like actually build it out, you know, like 10 years ahead, build themselves a business that is just paying their employees, you know? But that's another discussion. So what are some of the questions that you think or steps that should go through people's mind for them to decide what equipment would be right for me?
First thing is obviously what's on your menu, you know, because your menu is going to dictate what it is that you need to make and then how you need to make it. The other question that I really think is you have to reverse engineer the customer's experience, right? So when you're in a market, you're going to have customers that value different things, right? So I often make this comparison or just breakdown of this new generation of juice businesses that we're in now versus the ones we were probably in, you know, 15, 20 years ago, okay? There is the first generation juice bar, which most people were consuming the product primarily for the taste. I want an orange juice. I want apple juice, apple, orange, ginger. Sure, maybe it's healthy for me, but most people are like, yeah, this is refreshing and it's something sweet and it's, you know, so forth. And then the next generation of juice businesses, which where we are today, there's much more quality focused consumers. And so when you're making decisions about equipment, you have to understand what consumers value in the output, as well as you as a business, what your values are as a company. Because like, you know, vehicles, for example, if you, a caravan isn't better than a Ferrari, and a Ferrari isn't better than a caravan. It's circumstantial. So you have to understand, if you have a family, a Ferrari doesn't make sense because you can't fit everybody in the Ferrari for soccer practice. If you want to look cool and, you know, be flashy and drive fast, well, a caravan probably doesn't make sense because it doesn't accomplish those goals. And so many times when it comes to equipment, it's not that there, yes, there are, I think categorically, if you're going apples to apples, there's going to be equipment that just performs certain functions better, but there's also a need to be aware of what it is that you're doing and what your desired goals are for your equipment, as well as the ingredients you're processing. Because I found in general that there are certain kinds of juicers that just process different kinds of ingredients better. And another dimension to look at it from, let's say, is let's take like an automatic citrus press as an example. Okay. Does an automatic citrus press generally get all of the juice out of an orange that you probably would from a manual citrus press? No, but it's saving you on labor. So you have this like cross section of value for a company where if you're juicing one orange, it would make sense to use a manual citrus press. And let's say there's the number's not just one, right? Like it's somewhere in the range of like, okay, I'm juicing half a gallon. It makes the most sense because of the prep time to set up the manual citrus press, to clean it, all those things, and the efficiency you'll get out of it. But then there's a law of diminishing returns as you scale things out, right? The larger you get, it doesn't make sense anymore. And so this is why it's fundamentally important to know a few things. Ask yourself, you know, what do the consumers in my environment look for and value, or where is the trend? Because maybe there's an educational component. I'm getting people ready for this new wave of product that I'm bringing, right? Because somebody delivered cold pressed juice before they were doing centrifugal juice and had to explain and educate to the market what was going on. In some environments, it's still the case, and in some environments, not so much. People are prepared and they're ready for it. So understand the mindset of the consumer. Two, your values and goals as a business. Three, what's the scale at which you're going to be potentially selling this product? And that is probably the more difficult question to answer. There's ways that you can do research to get a sense of that. If you have competitors in your environment, how big it is, how can you set yourself up for that growth, so on and so forth. But that's going to really determine things for you, because if you think, oh, I'm going to sell 1,000 juices a day, and you're like, oh, I just sold 10. Well, you're off by magnitudes, and you know, spending $30,000 on a piece of equipment that you're only going to sell 10 juices a day, you know, you probably have to resell that to somebody else. It doesn't make sense. Whereas if you're wrong in another direction, you have to really be close within a reasonable margin of error. And if you ask yourself those three primary questions and say you're further down the pathway, Other aspects to consider are going to be how much space you have, because definitely the larger machinery is going to take up more space. Those are the ones that come to mind overall.
Okay, I think you led us straight into our next question, would be like, what are the most common phases of growth that you see from starting for juice bars or cold press juice brands?
Phases of growth in terms of, going from one store to multiple stores and that kind of trajectory?
Towards machinery, like the growth, obviously, when you're what's the growth?
Yeah, it goes in different directions sometimes, because once again, sometimes people's assumptions are wrong and they think they need more. Most of the time, that's not the case. I'd say, 20 or 30% of the time people are downgrading because they've overcommitted in terms of the machinery. But most of the time people are going from, we had a client that they were, to my knowledge, the first juice company in the nation, potentially even in the world, to do cold press juices to order. A company called Virtue Juice in Vacaville, California. And they had two smaller countertop models, and they just realized a lot of people were, especially when they're like getting catering orders and everything else, like, oh, we gotta upgrade to a larger unit now, because one, people aren't even waiting to do the juice into order. Even though it's fast, we have juices in the fridge that people want to really grab, because now they've trust us, that we've built trust, and we're like, you know what, we know these things are made in the morning, I'm going to save myself that 5 minutes of waiting for this juice to be made, I'm just going to grab a couple and go, because it also allows me to grab more. But then when it came to the point where they were doing larger events and they needed to get a larger machine, that's what they ended up doing. And so no matter what, if you are growing in that direction and dimension, you're going to have to keep scaling that out, unless you from day one have committed to a piece of machinery that can get you pretty far, which some people do. Some people do that. And then maybe eventually they just kind of double up, triple up on those kinds of units. And if they do have multiple stores, or maybe they go from like a situation where they've got a central store that kind of is their flagship central kitchen, as in they get these kind of hub and spoke models where they'll keep making the juice at a singular place. They'll start getting other, units here and there in the mall, by the gym, inside the gym, whatever. And then they'll just deliver from where they are to those locations. But that's usually what I see. I remember there was a project I worked on, and they were in the Middle East. And this was a company that was doing really big volume. And they, because the labor is pretty low comparatively to the US, they don't have the same minimum wage laws. They were in 100 locations. They didn't even have a press. They had a manual citrus, they had an automated citrus press. They were using a lot of orange juice, but everything else, they were using a centrifugal juicer every day to make.
Wow.
They were in 100 locations. I mean, the volume of juices they were making was pretty substantial. And we just started having conversations like, hey, you guys might want to start investing in commercial grade equipment, because this is why a lot of times when you have things that you can lean on, whether it's like you're doing a lot of the work, you don't feel that, even though it's uncomfortable for you, it's not uncomfortable enough for you to start thinking, I need to upgrade and change, because a lot of times it changes the model. Right, you have to go from, kind of use this analogy, like riding a bike and driving a car and having a helicopter and airplane. They're all means of travel, right? So in that way, you could say they're similar, but they're actually completely different when it comes to how fast you can go, how efficient it is, how much effort it takes from you, how much knowledge you have to operate those vehicles. And equipment is similar in that way. It's like they're all juicers, or blenders or whatever else it is, but they really kind of live in different categories and worlds when you start to need to move quicker, faster. And sometimes people don't know when the moment is that they actually need to make that transition, because of either the investment has to change, or some infrastructure has to change, or whatever, training for their staff has to change, whatever that is, that they're just comfortable with their system. They just keep doing that until it's really uncomfortable. And then they have to start looking at, okay, now what's the next step and the next level for me to upgrade from where I'm at. So I think these days, a lot of people are starting with more kind of countertop models, which I'm really not a big fan of. I get why people do it. And it's not to say that in every situation, I would tell someone not to do it. I think if you are not sure how much juice you're going to sell, and you're willing to absorb kind of the hit to your labor in the beginning, if that's the compromise you want to make in order to get a sense of the volume to then make that investment in a larger unit, then that's a route you can take. but it is going to be probably that learning's generally long-term going to be more expensive. It will save you money up front, but like I said previously, it's going to cost you more money in the long run. But that is an evolution that I see a lot of people now these days kind of considering and going through when it comes to, you know, the evolution of their juicers.
Yeah, we see people, you know, thinking about, they start in small, like, okay, well, let me get six of them. And that's the mindset. And then until they see they do the math and they're like, oh, wow, it's not doable for the business. But I also, like, I feel for the juice bars and the juice brands, because even I'm a year into this business and getting to know what machineries and what types, and like you said, it's not just like comparing apples to apples. It's completely different. And it's all I consume content and read, and it's a lot. So for a business owner that's maybe machinery is a fraction of everything they need to think about, and manufacturers and stuff don't make it easy as well. Like it's hard to find stuff to learn about. So I appreciate that, like a business like yours that kind of tells you everything. Is there, it could be a difficult question, but is there like some pain point that maybe are a little more nuanced that you'd be like, okay, you're feeling this, maybe going this way or maybe going that way that you could share that people can identify in their own business? Yeah.
I oftentimes feel very much like a doctor, and to a degree that's like everyone's situation, like there are principles and patterns that you see, but everyone's situation has to be analyzed individually. So for example, like if someone's selling a lot of wellness shots, it's like, okay, well, what's the ingredient that you're primarily using? Oh, is it ginger? Okay, it's ginger. Then what you're doing to juice that is not going to be the same thing if you're selling a lot of let's say, yeah, like orange juice or pineapple juice or something else, right? It's very different. And so that's why usually the pain point or bottleneck is usually efficiency. That's always the pain point. It's like, I have a lot of expenditure in my labor. And so how do I get that down? Because I'm not efficient enough. And then the question is, okay, in order for you to be efficient, it might be a combination of a multitude of different juicers, right? It could be for your citrus, you're using an automated citrus press. It could be for your base ingredients, you're using like a hydraulic press or a rolling press. And then for like your leafy greens, you're using something else, right? Because like, for example, you wouldn't really want to juice wheatgrass in a hydraulic press. It doesn't really make sense. That's why like a wheatgrass juicer is built for wheatgrass. And the auger presses I found in general are really good for those kinds of ingredients. But sometimes you don't have the budget, or it doesn't make sense for you to get a multitude of different juicers. So you kind of have to think about like which inefficiency are you going to optimize against or for, right? Like what are you gonna live with versus what's the primary core of what it is that you're doing? So the pain point is always lack of efficiency somewhere. And that could be yields, it could be labor. Those are the two really, right? And then you're gonna go, okay, well, how do we make you more efficient based on your menu? And like I said, there's going to be some things that do a better job and a wider range of products that they would probably utilize. Whereas sometimes you can get more specific and go, yeah, we sell a lot of orange juice and therefore we need to have an automated citrus press. And we're doing X, Y, and Z other things. So we need to have a rolling press, hydraulic press, or whatever else it is, right? So that's generally how it needs to be analyzed in my perspective.
My next question is more for social, so we can clip it. Can you give us like five or whatever amount that you can of the most cost-effective, easiest changes this impact for the business, just in general?
In terms of the most cost-effective changes a business can make in order to become more profitable, there's kind of what's easy and quick that's going to be effective. So usually looking at the menu. So menu is number one. And with the menu, there's a few things that you can do to modify a menu to make it more cost effective. You can, one, change your recipes, right? So that's portions inside the recipes. You can change the ingredients. So getting rid of full ingredients in the recipes and change them with things that are more cost effective and don't degrade the quality of the product. You can change the size, you can change the price, or you can change the vendors that you're working with, negotiate with them, or get new vendors. But that's going to be that's the easiest way that I find to increase profitability in a business. Then the next major cost, because you have two major cost categories, your food costs or product costs, known as cost of goods, and then your actual labor. Now, your labor is more difficult, generally speaking, because a lot of times labor is connected to people's personalities and it's a cultural thing because people want more hours or people aren't working fast enough or whatever that thing is. And so there's generally a lot more pressure and resistance when it comes to those things, unless you upgrade the equipment and you just make things faster. So then outside of having to put too much pressure on the people there, you can just say, hey, look, we've got this new piece of equipment. It's going to make your job a lot faster and you just need less hours to do X, Y, and Z, and you can do more. And hopefully your sales are growing while that's happening. Otherwise, you have to let people go. So these are the two biggest categories, and those are things that you can do to change them. And when it comes to managing labor, there's a handful of things you can do, right? I've given you more than five at this point. Maybe you're keeping count, but let's see. And then, so looking at scheduling, being very, very mindful with how you schedule your labor, because I say with labor, you have a proactive and a reactive approach. Proactive meaning I'm scheduling my labor ahead of time, knowing how much money I think I'm going to make for the day and how much labor I'm going to spend based on the schedule and what people's hourly wages are. And then reactive meaning how close am I to my projection? And if I'm not on the pathway to my target, then what am I doing to be responsive and reactive to then save myself money on what I need to do for that day? So it's calling people and telling them, hey, you know, you can clock out early, you know, just finish this, this, and this. And so you're having to manage labor that way. And then the next dimension to managing labor is just cultural. So how quickly are people moving in the space? What is the expectation for how much they need to do when, during a given day? So actually having, you know, like what they say, KPIs, like performance indicators for how much people need to produce at a given period of time. So it's much more structured, because when you don't manage those things that way, as someone once said, is you can expect what you inspect. So if you're not inspecting and really going deep into what you expect and managing that, then the outcome is going to be something that you probably don't like. So these are the two major categories. There's obviously other things you can do here and there, but they're not going to have as big of an impact, because between your labor and your cost of goods, you're looking at somewhere between 50 and 60% of your entire expenditure in the business, which is, you know, the vast majority.
How difficult do you see it when, because I'm assuming you guys give them all these templates to people for, key performance indicators for roles and what to inspect and what to keep track of. To see, you know, like even descriptions of job roles to give to your employees so they understand what they have to do and what's good and what's bad. I feel that's the difference between an amateur business owner or entrepreneur than a professional, because it makes it so much easier to not be like, well, that guy's not doing their job. Why aren't you doing it better? To being like, well, this is exactly what they need to do, because you want them guessing, because they'll probably do the wrong thing. And you'll be mad at them. You give that all to your clients. How many of them take it in, or like, what's the resistance there?
A lot of that's connected to people's personalities. I would say it's 50-50. And also it depends on what areas we're looking at, because what I find is that people have two distinct personality types of entrepreneurs. You have your very analytical, process-driven entrepreneur, systems-oriented entrepreneur. And then you have your very creative, marketing, branding, storytelling, kind of front-facing entrepreneur. These are usually two significant personality types. Now, the person who's very creative is not very systems-driven, but they can still be successful sometimes because they're really good with people. They're very charming, they're outgoing. There's something that's very like magnetic about their personalities, and that's good for bringing customers in. And even that quality can help them have good rapport with their staff and getting things done, but they might be a little bit more chaotic on the back end. And then you have sometimes the people who are much more back-end focused, and they can almost be clinical in their approach to people, and people don't really like them as much or whatever else. So to have that balance of both of those ways of being able to communicate well with individuals, be creative, be focused on the front end and the marketing and the growth of the business, as well as on the back-end process and everything else, it's a very rare kind of person who has both of those things in equal portions and can do them both very well. Not very good, not a lot of people. So I would say that when it comes to those things on the process side of a business, it's very new for a lot of people. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, is sometimes people don't get why. They don't get it. Like they don't really, really see why. And sometimes it's hard for them to implement something that they don't fully understand on a kind of visceral biological level, where they know that this makes sense. And so it's good that for them to have the tools. It's good for them to see that there. And then when it comes to like actually implementing, hey, this is why we do inventory on these days. This is how we do it. This is why they're just like, okay, sure. And some of them might follow it. Some of them might not follow it as closely because they don't know why the system exists. But sometimes that's okay, because I think it's partially that there are universal systems that people should follow, but then I also find that a lot of the systems that businesses should create are somewhat symptomatic to the culture of their company, right? So sometimes you need to put paperwork in some businesses that should be a given for another business, but it's just not a given for this company, you know, and you have to have this system in order to ensure the quality control of whatever that thing is, because for whatever reason, your staff has this way of doing something that you're like, that's not the way we do it. So therefore we have to implement this system to have a quality control mechanism in place. And I'm all for that. I'm not of the mind state that I think like part of the way we like to function is like, we want to get you as close to where you need to be as possible without suffocating you. We want to like leave that 10% or 20% of breathing room for you to understand what is behind the system. Because you never want to become a victim to your own creation. You need to know that it makes sense. And so I'll give you an example, kind of, you know, I heard at one point that McDonald's, they realized that they had about 2% of theft every year in their business. 2% of their gross revenue was being stolen, but it was gonna cost them about 3% in order to manage it. So they just let it go. They're like, if for us to put systems in place while getting rid of theft is good, but to really eliminate it 100%, it's going to cost us 3% of gross revenue as opposed to 2%. Then they realize that's the point of the point of the system is to save money, to make money, not to lose money. Now, they may have found that there was some other metric that it might have played a role in. Who knows, cultural morale, turnover, who knows what that thing is. But you have to know what the point of your systems are. And I think that's a lot of things that people have to grow into. But it's a lot when I've been doing this for 13 years. And to expect someone to get to a place where they have as much proficiency in a given industry, if someone who's been doing it for 13 years and 6 months or to a year, that's a lot to expect of somebody. But there are the people that come in that we work with that are very organized and very thoughtful about every single part of the process and want to implement and want to learn and ask good questions. And that to me is a personality thing. It's like you can't, I think that there are people who, once again, are entrepreneurial and they need to become entrepreneurs. And there are people who are just like, they run their lives like an entrepreneur. They have systems for everything. You know, it's like, okay, once I get out of the shower, the towel's here and then the mat's on the floor. And then every Wednesday I wash the mat. And then I have Amazon, you know, on auto recurring shipment for my toilet paper, and everything in their life is optimized. Those kind of people do really well, because that's the way you need to think as a business owner. But that's not most people. Most people don't. Most people are just trying to manage the chaos of their life and then starting a business on top of that. So it's far and few between. I'd probably say it's 20% that really take it on, where they can dive in 110%. And then some people are some variation of that, where they're like implementing 50, 60, 70%, but everyone's on their own trajectory and they have to learn the way that they can learn.
So it would come down to the communication and communicating how important certain things are, and then figuring out the rest if they work. And
sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just like, I find that it's, I don't have kids, but I empathize with parents. Sometimes I feel like I'm in that parenting role. And sometimes you have to know with a child, it's like, parents can tell their kids all day, hey, don't do this, don't do, but the child's like, you know what? That doesn't apply to me because I'm special, and people want to feel that way. And so they have to go through their own process. And so some people are just naturally much more receptive and they get it, and you can tell them something and it clicks. And for some people, it's not even a matter of, because I'll say something to someone like, hey, this is really, really, really important, and they don't get it and they don't listen. And then they kind of go off and do what they want to do to learn and come back. And hopefully those mistakes aren't critical and don't put them out of business. But sometimes it's just a matter of some people, everyone learns differently.
So we talked about the most costly changes. Tell me, what are the few things that you really don't mind investing heavily in the beginning?
This was a big one for me, and it took me a long time to really grasp this. Even after being a successful entrepreneur, which is very funny, because you can still succeed and do a lot of things horribly, and to a degree, I wouldn't say horribly, like to the worst degree, but you can still be like a 5 out of 10 in certain areas if you get certain things right, but you won't maximize your success. And the thing that I always like to remind you about success is it's not binary. It's not do I fail or do I succeed? It's a spectrum. It's how much do you succeed? And how much do you succeed is going to be byproduct of how well you function in all areas. And so the thing that it probably took me a really long time to grasp the importance of investing in is good design and good branding. Good branding and good design. Why? Why do people mostly overlook this? It's because when people are starting a business, they think about the things that are intrinsically valuable, right? Meaning intrinsic value, like I need equipment, I need recipes, I need a location, I need staff, because without those things, I can't run my business. And that's true. But the idea of having like great consistent design and a logo and really investing, they're like, yeah, I can just have a logo. I can just have a website for now. I can just whatever. I can have mediocre product photos because my product's gonna be so good, people are gonna love it and tell their friends, right? There's that perception, which is wrong. It's so wrong because perceptual value is actually more important than intrinsic value in a lot of ways. Perceptual value precedes intrinsic value. People have to perceive something as being valuable before experiencing the intrinsic value of a product. So if people don't have a high level of perceptual value, they will never get around to experiencing the intrinsic value. And the perceptual value, especially with something that's considered like something that you're eating, and in every dimension actually, the perceptual value influences people's intrinsic experience. They've done studies that have shown that when something is presented in a way that is of an elevated value, the neurology in people's brains change. How they taste and perceive something is actually different. And the way that I paint the picture for people to make it very, very straightforward and clear is that if I told you that what you're going to drink is the most expensive, highest quality wine that exists in the world, but I serve it to you out of a trash can, I told you, hey, the trash can's clean, it would be very difficult for your mind to disassociate the trash bin and what you're consuming. You would inherently feel a distaste for that product. Whereas if I told you, hey, this is an okay bottle of wine, but I gave it to you in a really nice bottle, the ambient environment's nice, there's nice music playing, the wine would taste a little bit better. You're in good company. Your multitude of senses play a role in your singular experience. And you can't separate those things. So how that relates to people's businesses is that if you have a really, really great brand, website, design, product photography, and your product's just kind of okay, well, guess what? You will still do better than a person who has a great product, but terrible design, terrible branding, terrible perceptual value, because people will still feel like, you know what? I don't really trust that company. I don't want to spend money there. There are some of the most amazing products and businesses that you and I have never heard of, right? Why? Because we just didn't trust them. It didn't look right. It didn't feel right. Something was wrong with the initial experience. In the same way that I, you know, said, like, if somebody came dressed as a fireman, but they're like, I'm not a firefighter. It's like, well, you would think that they were. In the same way that if someone was dressed like, you know, I don't know, a doctor, but they're like, I'm a firefighter. It's, these things don't connect. And so perception has played such a big role in how we experience the world and make decisions. And we don't often have the cognitive bandwidth to invest so much time and energy in trying to get to the bottom of every single company that presents itself to us. We just don't care. I always remind people that customers don't care about your company. They don't care about you. They're doing what's best for them and what they think is good for them. So don't take it personally. Don't get emotional about it. Just do what makes your company thrive and succeed. And so it took me a long time to get that. Even having a business where I felt like, you know, in all frankness, you know, my juice company was like, the brand was okay, but it was a 5 out of 10. It wasn't a 10. It was an average, the brand, but we made up for in other ways. But I can imagine if our brand was, and it got better over time as I reinvested in getting better photos and getting better design and other things like that. But, and even the store design and all those things. But if I had done that out of the gate, we would have been 5 times more successful, much faster and sooner. So that's the number one lesson I've learned in the probably past 5-6 years of being an entrepreneur, invest heavily in that, because when people perceive your company like a big company, they will treat you like a big company and they will have no qualms about spending money with your business because they trust you, right? Someone once said, which I believe, that trust is the only currency. Trust is the only currency in this world. And people don't do business with companies they don't trust. And when your brand and perceptual value is mediocre, then you lose trust. And when you lose trust, you lose money.
No, I thought you were going to go with one of your examples to this one, but like even marketing and branding, it's pricing, right? Like the study where they give three wine bottles to people and one's $5, $15, and $100, and they're like, try it and rate it, which one's more delicious? Which one do you like more? And everybody's, well, the $100 is the most, this the best. The 30 is like, it's okay. And then the $5 is just crap. And they tell them, oh, it's the same wine. But you perceive value with a higher ticket price. And that's how our mind works. And it sometimes it boggles people, but like, yeah. It's, mm-hmm.
And it also, that is going to also connect to what the value proposition of a product is, because wine in particular, one of the metrics that people connect value with is definitely pricing. And we do that in a lot of worlds too. But also wine is not so much of a commodity. So I think that wine can just like art, you can have a really large spectrum of pricing for art and jewelry and clothing. And there's these things that kind of live in that world. We're also part of the product being expensive kind of adds to the value of it, because people want to tell people how much they spent on it. And in some ways, something that they drink every day, like juice, it kind of can do that, but not as much as a bottle of wine. So I don't want people to think like, yeah, if you make your juice $30, put it in a thing. That doesn't work. But there obviously is some point where that law does play into these things. Definitely, 100%.
My final question, are there any particular things going on in the cold pressed juice industry right now that you're excited about, or challenges that the industry is facing that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think it's actually very interesting to see overall where like the iterations of the juice bar model, because what I see is happening, and it makes complete sense, is that a lot of places are like, from the category of juice bar, right? It's like juice bar. And I remember that Jamba Juice used to be Jamba Juice, and they didn't sell juice, and they were just Jamba. And they only, now they're Jamba because they only sell smoothies, but they were still Jamba Juice. And so I find that what's happening is that juice is kind of a gateway drug. It's like, it gets you into your health because it's something that you can just inject so much nutrition and so much vitality into your system all at once, but it's one component of a well-rounded diet. It's a one component of a complete lifestyle. And so the evolution that I'm seeing is a lot of these businesses are going from being strict like juice bars to like hybrid healthy juice bar cafes where they're selling more food items or some hot items, teas, acai bowls, and kind of a more well-rounded menu, which I think is good, because I always remind people that people eat three times a day and are going to drink a juice or smoothie once a day. And it's a component. Whereas you want to, once you have a relationship with a consumer, within reason, support them as a part of the matrix of your brand values. And if that's a healthy lifestyle and healthy eating, then you're going to say, okay, cool, I can sell some salads and I can sell some wraps and I can sell these avocado toasts and healthy desserts and that whole thing. I don't have to be a full-blown restaurant, but I see that there is that evolution towards incorporating more food items because people are going to eat and you also need more reasons for people to come. And so I like that's happening because to me, it feels more holistic in a lot of ways than strictly just fitting like, okay, 100% of my menu is going to be juice or 90% of my menu is going to be juice. It's like, yeah, have that there. And figure out what else you can support people with that's going to not overcomplicate your operations, but still allow people to come and spend more money at your establishment and see you really as the authority when it comes to their health. So that to me is definitely an evolution. And just overall, it's interesting because, you know, we're a global business. We help clients all over the world. It's interesting to see what other secondary markets are starting to pop up a lot. You know, people from the Middle East and Dubai and Saudi Arabia and other places where they have really been into juice for a while, but they've been very much into the singular juices. Like, oh, we just drink pomegranate juice, or we just drink orange juice or pineapple juice. And now they're like, oh, we see that this is a way of life and it's a lifestyle. It's not just something that we're drinking because we like juice. We're like, oh, people are getting healthier. And so it's really cool to see these other markets opening up and seeing them in the same way kind of leapfrog and catch up to where we are today and a little bit even behind. So I love seeing that as well. I think those are the most exciting things. And then always, you know, there's always new health trends. And I think that it's probably related to what I was saying previously, but in a different way. It's nice to see us find a more balanced approach to our health, because I think that these extremes, we kind of reverberate. You know, I think that society does this, and a lot of even on our lifestyle, our habits, sometimes we overcorrect. We're like, oh, I was very unhealthy. And for me, when I started on my health journey, I stopped drinking sodas. I'm going to drink a gallon of water every day. And it's like, I don't know if I need to drink a gallon of water every day, but maybe that's what I needed to do in order to cleanse my palate and stop drinking soda all the time. And then now I find this balance, like, okay, maybe I'll drink 2 or 3 liters of water a day or whatever that is, but I'm exercising and I'm eating well and I'm kind of finding this more holistic approach. And I think the same thing is happening when it comes to people's diets and lifestyles. I think that there's a lot of like, oh, we got to be paleo, or we got to be vegan, or we got to be, you know, I'm going to be juicing all the time, I'm going to be fruitarian, and like kind of people touching the edges of these extremes. At least for me, what I would view as extremes. And then now they're finding that, oh, probably what it is actually just not eating as much processed food, getting a good sleep, getting good rest, drinking juice, having my smoothies, you know, eating my salads, doing this thing, just figuring out what works for each individual. And I think that's really a beautiful place to be. And then having the business models that support these different kinds of journeys that people are on.
I think that's the perfect place to stop the show. Anything else you'd like to add? Would you like to give a little bit of a summary or last takeaway, or you think we're good?
No, it's great. I'm glad that we're taking this on. I think for anybody, depending on where they're at in their journey of this business, the last thing that I want to say and always remind people is that it's really important work. It's really meaningful and it's really fulfilling if you say yes to that in yourself and know that your community needs it. For me, one of all the challenges that I went through in starting this company and all of the, you know, sleepless nights and stress, there were moments where people came to me and said, you know, if it wasn't for your business, I don't think I'd be here today. Like, so I'm really glad, you know, I had this really big health crisis and I decided to change my diet and was coming to your business every day. And these are things that were revealed to me even sometimes years and years later. And I was like, wow. You don't even know the people that you're impacting. You don't even know who you're helping. You don't know all the time. And that to me is, there's no amount of money in the world that can make up for giving someone a better quality of life. And that to me is what it's about. And so I just encourage everybody who's thinking about doing it to do it smart. But the world needs it. And the world needs more businesses and to have access to healthier products overall, because we all know that the world is just inundated with stuff that's harming people and their health. So that's our mission, and I want people to join us.
Beautiful thing when you do something that makes you happy and help people and makes you a little bit of money too.
Exactly.
Well, thank you everybody for tuning in to this episode of The Fresh Press. Make sure to drop us a line, let us know if you enjoyed this episode, and go check out Andrew's businesses. We'll link them below.
Hey guys.
Thank you.